Hey, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Daily Call Podcast for the 29th day of October 2019. It's a Tuesday, and what a Tuesday. Well, what a Monday it was, since it's 2 o'clock in the morning. We just spiked the football on Monday, unless you're California or Hawaii or Alaska, I guess. So we'll look back at what was on Monday. Democrats are actually going to put impeachment to a vote. What do you know about that? The congresswoman who resigned in disgrace is now portrayed as a victim of sexism and double standards. This stuff is, it's ridiculous. And a whole bunch of media lefties are upset over the way that al-Baghdadi was killed. One in particular beclowned himself in a new way. I would say, you know, beclowned himself, period, but Max Boot does it all the time. So we'll get into that. We also talked to my buddy Dan Gabriel. I thought, well, let's try some new tech. A listener, a very nice listener, sent me a microphone that plugs into the computer, and I tried to use it on Skype, and I still got to learn how to figure out how to work it properly, but it worked. And Dan Gabriel is a former CIA agent, field operative, means he was out there doing the stuff. And he knows a thing or two about this area of the world, having directed the documentary Mosul, for which he was on this show 3 months ago, 4 months ago, something like that. Cool guy, smart guy. I talked to him about what the death of Baghdadi means, whether it means anything. We get into a whole bunch of stuff having to do with the Middle East. You'll like it. It's only about 20 minutes long, and I'll throw that in near the end, and you'll appreciate it. But thank you for listening, downloading, telling a friend, spreading on social media, writing and reviewing on iTunes. I appreciate everything you do. We only grow because of you. That is not just sucking up. It's the truth. Okay. If you want to enter to win a signed copy of Jarrett Stepman's book, The War on History, you have until 10 p.m. Thursday to email Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. I will announce the winners on Friday's show. There'll be two winners. And I'll announce the winners on Friday's show. And then we'll start the David Limbaugh cycle, because I'm sitting down with the very cool guy, David Limbaugh, good friend, helped me out a lot, did pro bono work for me when my book was coming together, when the contract was being offered. I didn't have a lawyer. And he looked at my contract and gave me pointers and notes and made some changes. He's just, he didn't have to. He probably shouldn't have. I mean, who the hell am I? But he was nice enough to do that. Super cool guy. Looking forward to getting a chance to hang out with David yet again and talk about his great new book. So all that's coming this week. Let's just look forward to that and get on with the show, shall we? But first, let's talk about our great sponsor, Life Change Tea. Let me tell you about Life Change Tea. It is a game changer. Since I've been drinking Life Change Tea, I notice I feel so much better and I have so much more energy. So how does it work? It's not caffeine tea. Life Change Tea is a proprietary herbal formula. It's a gentle daily cleanse designed to clean out your insides, designed to rid your body of harmful intruders. It's the tea that makes you go. Let's face it, our food was different 60 years ago, minimally processed, free of pesticides, nourishing and healthy for your body. Today, not so much. Pesticides, herbicides, and heavy, heavy, heavy processing have depleted nutrition from our food. It's no wonder you feel so run down. Get the stuff out of you so your body can absorb the good stuff you're putting in you. Try it for yourself. Go to getthetea.com now. That's getthetea.com. Get ready for more energy. I drink it every day. I got a fresh gallon sitting chilling in the fridge right now. Make sure you use as directed. Don't overdo it. It works, and it works well. Life Change Tea is not available in stores. You go to getthetea.com. Enter promo code Derek at checkout. You get free shipping. You can't beat that deal, and you'll thank me for it. That's getthetea.com. Okay, the big story yesterday and today is that the Democrats are finally going to do their business. They're not going to get off the pot. Allegedly, it's not until Thursday, so who knows? New York Times has the story headline, Democrats move toward bringing impeachment inquiry public. It's about time. House Democrats moved quickly on Monday to bring their impeachment case against President Trump into the open, saying they would forego court battles with recalcitrant witnesses who would vote this week And would vote this week on procedures to govern nationally televised hearings. We're finally going public. Why haven't we gone public before? Why have we only gotten leaks before? We'll have more on leaks in a second. Representative Adam B. Schiff, the House Intelligence Committee chairman leading the inquiry, began the day by telling reporters that Democrats would not wait to fight the Trump administration in court as it moved to block key witness testimony. Instead, he warned that White House directives not to cooperate, like the one that stopped Mr. Trump's former deputy national security advisor from appearing Monday morning, would simply bolster their case that the president had abused his office and obstructed Congress's investigation. The uncritical nature of this story is shocking. By the afternoon, Nancy Pelosi added to the sense of momentum. She announced that after weeks of private fact-finding, don't you love it, private fact-finding? When Democrats do anything, it is so official-sounding. We're just fact-finding. It's not a witch hunt. Called a witch hunt is absurd and partisan, but it is fact-finding, private fact-finding, behind closed doors, where all fact-finding takes place. Democrats could have written this themselves. Of course, it ran in the pages of the New York Times, so there's a good possibility Democrats did write this themselves. After weeks of private fact-finding, the full House would vote on Thursday to initiate a new public phase of the inquiry by establishing rules for the public presentation of evidence and outlining due process rights for Mr. Trump. It will be the first time all House lawmakers will be asked to go on record on the investigation since it began in September, something Democrats had so far resisted. Bum, bum, bum. Actually, they haven't resisted. The House has voted in the past to launch impeachment inquiries against President Trump, and they went down in flames. Democrats are attempting to spin this latest version of Mueller, or the Russia hoax, or wherever, whatever you choose to peg it to, into something really, really dastardly, something really, truly threatening to the existence, the existential threat, as they love to say about climate change, of our republic. But there's kind of a problem. The president has released all the information. Now, you can not like the information, but if you're trying to claim that the president is trying to obstruct an investigation, he's declassified everything classified related to this, and it's out there for the public to read. I've read the transcript on this very program. So that's a really weird way to obstruct. The New York Times has another story, and I think this might be pegged to why Democrats are feeling a little bit cocky today. I know that most liberals on social media last night, the activist types, meaning the journalists, and the pseudo-conservative intelligentsia who love to get booked on CNN, so they sell whatever souls they happen to have to do just that, people like Matt Lewis, had their panties wadded and crammed straight up their rear ends over the prospect of this next story. The story, the headline, Army officer who heard Trump's Ukraine call reported concerns. Again, from Washington, D.C., New York Times, a guy named Danny Hakim reporting. A White House national security official who is a decorated Iraq war veteran plans to tell House impeachment investigators on Tuesday that he heard President Trump appeal to Ukraine's president to investigate one of his leading political rivals, a request the aide considered so damaging to American interests that he reported it to a superior. Oh no, I've got to go and rat on the boss. He suggested, well, we have the problem with this story, and the problem with all the excitement around this story is very simple. We have the transcript. There's no ambiguity. This isn't, you know, a he said, she said situation. We have the official White House document of the phone call, and it shows no such thing. The story continues. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander S. Vindman, V-I-N-D-M-A-N, of the Army, a top Ukraine expert on the National Security Council, twice registered internal objections about how Mr. Trump and his inner circle were treating Ukraine out of what he called a sense of duty. He plans to tell the inquiry, according to a draft of his opening statement obtained by the New York Times. Oh, a draft of his opening statement? Wait a second. I thought all of these proceedings were behind closed doors and Republicans were perhaps history's greatest monsters for violating the sanctity of the secure facility in which these testimonies were being taken. How is it that this got out to the New York Times? That's weird. He will be the first White House official to... And I love, by the way, he felt out of a sense of duty. Duty to what? Duty to where? Well, it turns out that this guy is a Ukrainian national. He's now an American, but, you know, I'm wondering what his duty is. And even if you had the least generous reading of the transcript, if you took the Adam Schiff dramatic they called it satire, dramatic interpretation of the Trump transcript with the president of Ukraine, what in there was so disturbing that it twice needed to be reported? You must register. I feel compelled, sir, to tell you that I am upset over what the president said. What did he say? He said he wanted to get to the bottom of Ukraine's involvement in meddling in the 2016 election. Oh, okay. I don't really see the problem with that. Yes, sir. But he also, 540 words later, and in an unrelated discussion, mentioned Joe Biden and his little corrupt crack-smoking son, Hunter, who made a fortune out of Ukraine by sitting on the board of a company he knew nothing of. I'm not even sure he's ever been to Ukraine. I know he doesn't speak Ukrainian, and he has no expertise in oil and gas, but still he was hired for his, I don't know, what was his expertise? Procuring hookers and coke for the board meetings? Maybe. That's where the wheels come off this story. That's where the wheels come off this sentiment, this idea. Ooh, this guy was so disturbed. The New York Times continues, he will be the first White House official to testify who listened in on the July 25th telephone call between Mr. Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine that is at the center of the impeachment inquiry, in which Mr. Trump asked Mr. Zelensky to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden Jr. That is, again, just like I demonstrated, 540 words in between the mention of do me a favor, get to the bottom of Ukraine's involvement in meddling in the 2016 election, and any mention of Joe Biden. 540 words later. Now, when you're running your conversation through translators and in a room full of people, making sure that every answer is as precise as possible, it's like a phone call by committee. Just imagine how awful that would be. So 540 words is quite a bit. You have to say something, and then it has to be translated, and you have to say something more, it has to be translated. Then the other people say something. They have to discuss amongst themselves, probably, how to respond. Then they come back, and that's translated. So 540 words, I suspect, because it's about a five-page transcript, it was a 30-minute phone call, and this is one of the big conspiracy theories of the left. That's not a real transcript. That's not a record of the call. It was a half-an-hour phone call, and there's only five pages of dialogue there. They're hiding something. They're hiding something. It's called translators. And it's weird because when you're dealing with world leader to world leader, they want their translations to be as precise as possible. They don't like nuance getting into the way. Nuance tends to not be the friend of democracy, of diplomacy. So they're very, very careful on both ends. Measured conversations. No, you know, president calls up another president and they just shoot the breeze and talk about chicks they used to date or what. No, that's not how it works. It is a very intricate dance. So that it took some time is not a surprise. So 540 words is actually quite a bit of time. There's a lot of translating going on. The story continues. So yes, the New York Times is lying there again. But they're counting on you not having read the transcript. Well, I've read it for you, and I encourage you to go out and find the transcript and read it again for yourself so you can see what I am saying is true. Quote, now this is Colonel Vindman speaking from his testimony that somehow ended up in somebody's inbox at the New York Times. Quote, I did not think it was proper to demand that a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen, and I was worried about the implications for the U.S. government's support of Ukraine. Why? You're an American citizen now. Yeah, you immigrated from Ukraine, but why would you care? Should you, if, you know, doesn't that strike anybody as weird? I was worried about the implications for U.S. government's support of Ukraine. Why are you, you know, I'm part German, I'm part Italian, I'm part Irish, I'm part French-Canadian, I'm part everything you can possibly imagine. My ancestors, as far as we know, started off in Poland and basically screwed their way west. And I am not concerned with any one of those stops along the way. I am an American citizen, first and foremost, and exclusively. And so my concern is for the United States of America. That's just me. He continues, I realize that if Ukraine pursued an investigation into the Bidens and Burisma, the company Burisma, it would likely be interpreted as a partisan play, which would undoubtedly result in Ukraine losing the bipartisan support it had thus far maintained. Now, again, don't you love this? This guy's motivation is very, very, very much tied up in concern, not for the United States, but for Ukraine. He's concerned about Ukraine. I was worried about that the truckloads of money we've been throwing at Ukraine over the years might dry up. Meanwhile, Democrats have literally said in letters to the president of Ukraine that if you don't help us nail Trump, we will go after your funding. We will cut your funding. Has that made national news? Have the Democratic senators who sent these letters to Ukraine, have they come under investigation? No, they haven't. They haven't even come under stink eye from the mainstream media because they don't really care about this. This is about getting Donald Trump. This is the latest vehicle that they've chosen. This is the one they're choosing, at least as of now, to ride off into the sunset on. But in general, it used to be, Russian meddling, and it was the wait for the Mueller report, then it was obstruction of justice of the Mueller report, you name whatever it was, they were prepared to impeach Donald Trump. The actual impeachment vote in the House of Representatives was over Trump's tweet telling the Gang of Four to go back to the countries they came from and fix them and come back and show us how it's done. That was, you know, grounds for impeachment for a bunch of Democrats. So this whole thing stinks to high heaven. I find it very curious that this guy is so concerned about Ukraine, about how upset and how things could. This quote, this would all undermine U.S. national security. How? How would that, no offense to any Ukrainian listeners out there, but to be perfectly honest, in the grand scheme of things, our national security would not really be all that impacted if Russia took over all of Ukraine. Now, the concept of liberty that we stand for as a nation certainly would, and our influence in the region could wane. But in general, it's not, well, first goes Kiev and then goes Washington, D.C., so that is our firewall. Not at all, not remotely. But this guy seems very, very concerned. The Colonel, a Ukrainian-American immigrant who received a Purple Heart after being wounded in Iraq, his testimony is full of references to duty and patriotism. Could be more difficult, a more difficult witness to dismiss than his civilian counterparts. Why? I don't think so. It's his interpretation. He's a low-level functionary with a healthy affinity for Ukraine. Why should his opinion matter a whit at all? Yet this seems to be what the Democrats are pinning their hopes on in order to move to an official open impeachment. They want to bring this guy public. They don't want to bring the whistleblower forward anymore. The whistleblower's gone the way of the dodo. It's kind of funny that the media and the Democrats have foregone the whistleblower. Adam Schiff announced the other day that he's not interested in the whistleblower anymore, and he doesn't think that the whistleblower needs to talk, doesn't need to testify, doesn't really matter anymore. Why? Well, because the whistleblower was third-hand rumor. All they really needed was the one snowflake to start an avalanche, and that's what they got out of the whistleblower. We'll never know who it was. Maybe, maybe not. Daily Beast has a story. Nunes, meaning Devin Nunes's aides, is leaking the Ukraine whistleblower's name, sources say. Now, this, is another telling sign about the state of journalism. It took three reporters, in air quotes, to write this story. Spencer Ackerman, Sam Brody, and Adam Rawlinsley. A top aide to Representative Devin Nunes has been providing conservative politicians and journalists with information and misinformation about the anonymous whistleblower who triggered the biggest crisis of Donald Trump's presidency, two knowledgeable sources told the Daily Beast, Adam Schiff and Adam Schiff. Derek Harvey, who works for Nunes, the ranking Republican on the House Intelligence Committee, has provided notes for Republicans identifying the whistleblower's name ahead of the high-profile deposition of Trump administration appointees and civil servants in the impeachment inquiry. The purpose of the notes, one source said, is to get the whistleblower's name into the record of the proceedings, which committee chairman Adam Schiff has pledged to eventually release. In other words, it's an attempt to out the anonymous official who helped trigger the impeachment inquiry. Now, if this guy, and I don't know him, Derek Harvey, although I like his first name, if he's out there trying to get this whistleblower's name into the public domain, why aren't any of these three so-called journalists remotely interested in what the whistleblower's name is? Isn't that a little bit weird? Shouldn't journalists be interested in such things? I would think that that would be a gold star. You'd want to know. You'd want to be the reporter to uncover the whistleblower's identity. Whether you report it or not is another matter, but you want to launch an investigation. You want to see, hey, is this person really as connected to Democratic Party politics as the Trump administration says? Or is he as pure as the wind-driven snow as Democrats say? A real journalist would look at that and say, I don't care. It's not up to me to judge the information. It is up to me to get the information and disseminate it. But they have no interest in the whistleblower and their identity. Oddly enough, this entire piece on the Daily Beast is about this mean SOB Republican staffer who's allegedly trying to get it out there to the people. Could you imagine 5 years ago, journalists demonizing somebody, an entire 1,000-word piece written by three so-called journalists, demonizing somebody for trying to get information into the public? Could you imagine that? No, you can't. But things are different now. Donald Trump is president of the United States, and Trump derangement syndrome has spread like that disease in The Stand or whatever caused all the zombies in The Walking Dead. They're not interested in the whistleblower's identity. They're interested in attacking and hopefully trying to get fired the person who is trying, allegedly, on the inside, to get this person's name into the record. Now, if somebody wants to get the whistleblower's name out there, email it to me, Derek@dailycaller.com. You know, or there are tens of thousands of other reporters out there who would be ecstatic to have the whistleblower's name for the very reasons I laid out. I don't think it would be splashed across the headlines of any newspaper or news website, but I think there are a lot of questions about this person's identity and motive that a lot of people would like to have answered. And we're not even allowed to ask the questions now. And the journalists are now trying to attack somebody for daring to try to get this third-hand information, so-called whistleblower, out to the public so that we might gauge their credibility on our own. The left has no interest in us, we Americans, gauging anybody's credibility. They want to tell us what to think. They want to think on our behalf. And sadly, there's 40% of this country, known as Democrats, who are quite content to have their thinking outsourced to people like these three hack reporters who are very upset that some information might make its way out to the public. Now, I guarantee you that any one of these three reporters, if you leaked something that was damaging to national security from the Trump administration that could make the Trump administration look bad, let's just say, for example, in the al-Baghdadi raid, if it turns out that he had blown himself up before then or whatever, there was something, it would have to do something with national security, that was a threat that could jeopardize certain things, they wouldn't think twice. It would make Trump look bad. They would run with it. They would report it. They wouldn't look back. They couldn't give a damn. But because the name of the whistleblower might shed some light on some of the motives behind what's going on in Washington, D.C., behind closed doors, which, by the way, also doesn't seem to bother journalists, so-called journalists, then they're not interested in it. They couldn't care less. Journalism is dead. It hanged itself in a fit of autoerotic asphyxiation. And its corpse is still just dangling there with that one arm, sort of, maybe it was hooked up to a record player or something, but it's still going, because they're still going. Okay, enough about journalistic necrophiliac masturbation. I know that's why you downloaded the show today, but, you know, I hope you've gotten your fix on that. There are other things I want to get to, plus the Dan Gabriel chat. I want to point out a little bit, though, that the with the new Democratic frontrunner in some polls, not all polls, some polls, Elizabeth Warren, I think the Democrats are a little bit nervous. They don't really I don't think they think she can win. Mostly because I'm not convinced that she can win. While an alarming number of millennials support socialism and even have a favorable view of communism, and it's really kind of sad. One in three millennials, according to a new survey, have a favorable view of communism. Can you imagine that? And 70% support the idea of socialism. These are millennials. If you have millennial children, talk to them. Send them somewhere. Prevent them from voting if you cannot talk sense into them. My God, this is the benefit of growing up in a world where communism had been defeated, where we won the Cold War. Unfortunately, we didn't can't obliterate an ideology, and that ideology metastasized into the education system. And so you've got the fifth column in this country being a whole bunch of white liberals who don't understand what happened in their lifetime. They don't understand the evils of communism, or worse yet, they look at the evils of communism and go, yeah, that seems about right. 50 million dead, 100 million dead, whatever, you know, 40 million in China, 50 million in the Soviet Union, or you can reverse those numbers. Nobody really knows because the bodies were stacked too high. The air got too thin when we got near the top to be able to continue counting. But it's scary, scary stuff that anybody would think that way. And it's unlikely, since thank God, at least as of now, and again, if you have millennial children, brothers, sisters, cousins, whatever, make sure they don't vote. Tie them to the radiator accidentally. Just kidding. Mostly. So they're looking at somebody like Elizabeth Warren, who wants to bring that sort of mentality to our government, to the White House, to the presidency. Free this, free that, super duper taxes on everybody, let's have a wealth tax, blah blah blah. I mean, you just go down the line, it's insane. And don't cross her, she'll sign an executive order making you illegal and throw you in a re-education camp. Well, with that in mind, they recognize that while Joe Biden is a horrible candidate, Elizabeth Warren is a worse candidate. Even though she has her faculties, she's able to string together a coherent sentence, she's has a good, well, I'd say a better memory when it comes to her own biography, but that's not even true either. She has her own baggage. They're starting to panic a little bit. So they're wishing, and you see these stories, we talked about them last week, where they're kind of worrying, wishing, hoping, pining for somebody else. I'd love to see a somebody else or none of the above on the ballot in the Democratic primary just to see how that goes. Could you imagine? So with that in mind, the Democratic establishment has been, it looks like, planning to maybe try to damage or at least slow down some of the momentum of Elizabeth Warren. That brings us to another piece by the New York Times. The headline, Elizabeth Warren's Days Defending Big Corporations. Under normal circumstances, in normal times, in a rational political party, that Elizabeth Warren, when she was practicing law as a young Native American squaw up at Harvard, had some corporate clients would not be news. Maybe, I mean, if there was some egregious case or something, perhaps, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the concept that Elizabeth Warren represented as an attorney, corporations. The story, just a little bit of it. Elizabeth Warren had never taken on the federal government before, but in 1995, she found herself up against the Clinton administration representing the Cleveland-based conglomerate LTV Steel. Even though LTV Steel had sold off its coal mines during the 1980s, a new law required it to contribute to a health fund for retired miners. LVT believed that it should not have to pay. Those claims, the company said, should have been handled as part of its bankruptcy reorganization. Ms. Warren's job was to convince the Supreme Court to hear LTV's case. The court declined, so a little squaw lost. But for Ms. Warren, the issue would fester. Now, listen to that. It would fester. And it came up in a run for the Senate against Scott Brown. The LTV case was part of a considerable body of legal work that Ms. Warren, one of the nation's leading bankruptcy experts, took on while working as a law professor, moonlighting that earned her hundreds of thousands of dollars. Isn't that nice? Mostly while she was on the faculty at Harvard. Well, all these corporations, they wanted to have minority representation. But it's telling, and I just want to comment on this for a second. These companies, according to everything that is in the, you know, the American judicial tradition, absolutely positively deserve their day in court, their right to a hearing, their right to try in court. Yet this is now being floated in none other than the pages of the New York Times as a problem for Elizabeth Warren. See, she doesn't want evil corporations having anything to do with anything, yet people are noticing that, hey, wait a second, you got plenty rich off of representing corporations, Elizabeth Warren. Now, the idea that everybody deserves a lawyer is uniquely American, I think. It's definitely American. So it shouldn't come as a shock to anybody. But that a corporation, that corporations, many corporations, would hire Elizabeth Warren, and more importantly, that Elizabeth Warren would take their dirty blood money, is enough to turn off Democrats. They look at that as disgusting because in their world, some people and some entities, and particularly people who work for the entities they deem to be the enemies of the state and of the people. You know, Donald Trump denounces the enemy of the press is the enemy of the people, and the left goes absolutely crazy. The Democratic voting base and the entirety of their field running for president denounce corporations as the enemies of the people and of the entire planet. And everybody goes, yeah, that sounds about right. That sounds good to me. So I find it interesting that now Elizabeth Warren is getting into a little bit of trouble, into a little bit of controversy, and I suspect in the November debate, this could become a bit of an issue. Someone like Kamala Harris, desperate for attention, could chime in and say that Elizabeth Warren has worked her whole life, her whole adult life, to the benefit of corporations, when in fact she's just a lawyer who took on clients. Personally, I love to see this kind of infighting because, as I always say, and those of you new to the program should learn this, Frankenstein's monster always returns to the castle. They create this woke mob that goes out and six conservatives, attacks anybody who isn't sufficiently liberal, who isn't woke enough according to their own standards. And it always boomerangs. It comes back because they can't live up to the standards that they set. For years, Democrats were used to not being held to the standards that they set. Their fellow travelers in the media would never dream of holding them to the same standards they hold conservatives to. But the angry mob itself now can no longer be controlled. And many of them are entering the professional workforce. Many of them are, you know, junior staffers at the New York Times. And quite frankly, if somebody comes out and is raging enough, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, they will go after their own a little bit. It's a little bit of self-cannibalism. And I, for one, love to see it. I would like to see Elizabeth Warren's answer to the allegations because as sensible as what I said is, everybody and everything deserves representation and they have a right to avail themselves of our court system. While that makes rational sense to rational people, the base of the Democratic Party is no longer that. The base of the Democratic Party is really, really looking for an absolutely pure, woke individual to get their support. That's about 35% of the Democratic Party, not all of it. But if, especially with this many people in the field, if they all coalesce around somebody, that could push somebody over the edge. It's probably the largest single voting block in the Democratic Party. So it's going to be fun to watch Elizabeth Warren squirm because there's the obvious answer and there's the answer that will appease the mob. And they are two entirely different things. I just love it. Love it when their feet are held to the fire. Okay, let's stop here and go to the Dan Gabriel interview about the death of al-Baghdadi and what it means for the Middle East. I got to say, it's a new microphone that I'm using in this that I hooked up to the computer to record Skype. So the quality of the audio isn't quite what I'd like it to be, but you can make it out. It sounds fine. Sounds like most other podcasts out there. It's just that for this part of the show, I happen to have a really good microphone. This one only plugs into an iPad, so and it only works with one app. It's a long story. Don't ask. But I think it's pretty good quality-wise, and it's definitely good content-wise. And then we'll come back and we'll have more stories on the other end.
So yesterday I told you about the death or the untimely death, sad news over at the Washington Post about Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the founder and leader of ISIS. And then it turns out that his number two got number two'd yesterday, too. So it's been a great, great time for the United States of America. And I thought I could opine on this thing all day long and really kind of screw up and not know what the hell I'm talking about. So let's get somebody who does know what they're talking about. And I thought, hey, my buddy Dan Gabriel. He's a CIA guy. He's a filmmaker. He was on the show back when his documentary Mosul was coming out, which is now available on iTunes, Amazon, and Google Play, and I highly recommend you check it out. So as part of the experiment of expanding the show, he joins us live via tape while we're live together. Dan, welcome to the show.
Derek, great to be back. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. My pleasure. So I know that you know more than you can probably say, which is cool and pisses me off because I hate it when people know things they can't tell me. But when you first heard the news about al-Baghdadi's, that we got him, what was your immediate thought as somebody who's focused on this region?
Well, you know, I was sitting there reading through the Washington Post obituaries, and I came across Baghdadi, you know, much to my surprise, along with, you know, my ninth grade chemistry teacher. There was Baghdadi in there. Curious, of course, how that ended up, you know, whether Joby Wark, you know, wrote that as an obituary or was that like an editorial decision? But I diverge. I don't think I've seen the obituary for the second in command. Of course, the second in command position for ISIS has a very, very short life expectancy, not a position you would want. But yeah, absolutely. Great news this weekend. You know, President Trump said bigger than the bin Laden kill operation. You know, probably it's the difference between tactics and strategy. Certainly bin Laden eluded capture for so long and was responsible for, you know, so many American deaths in such a visually atrocious way that I think he's probably holds a higher pedestal in the American psyche than Baghdadi does. But if we're talking about Baghdadi, we are talking about somebody that basically took over two-thirds of Syria and about a third of Iraq, and killed tens and tens of thousands of people, caused about 3 million refugees to pour into Europe, you know, got Russia back involved, in, got us kind of at loggerheads with them again, and has made a mess out of our foreign policy for really the last 6 years. So, yeah, I mean, Baghdadi, I think, is more, more of the figurehead or the poster child for, you know, let's say, foreign events, current events from 2012, you know, perhaps the second part of the first part of this century, whereas bin Laden was kind of the turn of the century guy. But yeah, this, I mean, this guy has done some atrocious things to Americans as well. Of course, the killing of the reporter, James Foley, and many, many more atrocities.
Can you equate or quantify what the death of a leader does to an organization, a terrorist organization, sort of as diverse as far as geography goes, like ISIS? And can you compare that to the death of bin Laden, who seemed to be isolated in Abbottabad, and almost living a life where he's passing notes to people through intermediaries? He didn't seem to have he certainly wasn't on the battlefield, and whether or not he had day-to-day operational control over the organization, I suppose, is a matter for debate for people like you. But it seemed as though al-Baghdadi was out in the field, was on the battlefield, or at least seemed to be more directly in control of it. Am I reading that wrong?
Well, look, this is a guy that was not afraid to get his hands bloody. That's for sure. Appearing in ISIS execution videos, some of which we've got in the film Mosul that you mentioned. You know, again, I think it's really a difference between tactics and strategy, whereas, you know, bin Laden was certainly not just the figurehead, but also the operational mind behind al-Qaeda. But he was really in hiding from the moment the Twin Towers fell until the moment that the Navy SEAL put a bullet between his eyes. So from that perspective, I think you're right that Baghdadi was really, certainly appears to be more mobile. I mean, back to bin Laden, he had been hanging out in Abbottabad for over a year, whereas Baghdadi, it appears that he may have only been in that particular location outside of Idlib where he was found for maybe 48 hours. So yeah, Baghdadi was moving around and seems to have been more involved in the day-to-day operations. But in terms of the level of control that he had over ISIS per se, I would almost go in the opposite direction and say that it perhaps was less control than bin Laden exerted over al-Qaeda, which had much more of a hierarchy. I think ISIS has really become more of an idea, whereas al-Qaeda was kind of more in line with the old school terrorist networks built on cells and training groups and guys that served with each other, you know, in the Afghan war. Of course, that's what makes ISIS and continues to make ISIS so dangerous, is that because it is an ideology, you know, basically Baghdadi ascended the minaret in Mosul, declared a caliphate and said he's the caliph. And then everything kind of fell into place after that without him necessarily giving too many orders. Everybody kind of knew what to do. And you see that with all these different groups that were in some ways moving towards the same goal, even though they might be under a different flag.
You have a situation where we found out, allegedly a few months ago, this is just based on reporting that I've seen and read so far, we found out perhaps back in May about roughly where he was and moving around. And the CIA, I assume, embedded a couple of Americans in the area to sort of act as natives. Does that sound, and sort of get the lay of the land and make sure that he was actually there, does that sound right? How would you describe an operation like this? As I imagine the CIA gets all kinds of tips constantly that they see everybody, you know, they see Elvis at a shopping mall, and they have to be able to chase them down. When you get something as clear as this guy is where we expect him to be generally, how does the CIA proceed from there to verify rather than just blow up a building just in case he was there?
Yeah, well, look, it starts, you know, again, at a very microscopic and almost human level with really a piece of information, a human to lead, human intelligence that says so-and-so may be here or hiding out here. And then what happens is that intelligence agencies work backwards from that, and then they'll try to corroborate it with other types of intelligence collection. So there could be measurements, you know, whether taken by satellite photography or SIGINT. So you name it, it could be any one of those things. That's what we saw with the bin Laden kill operation. It was a human source that gave a tip. And then, you know, verification over a number of months, DNA sampling, you know, that make-believe, I guess, vaccine program that they use to kind of get DNA from some of the relatives and in the neighborhood. That's kind of how they corroborate and validate to make sure that they're looking at the right target. But this sounds like a case where it's in the wheelhouse of the CIA, human operations driven by human assets, starting with an American case officer, probably more likely than not working with an asset. So the people that you're referring to as American CIA people in Syria were probably assets of some sort and were being perhaps handled or run out of different parts of Syria. But that's the job of an asset. Sometimes people confuse what is a case officer versus what is an agent or an asset. So your assets or your agents probably would have been the people that would have been living across the street and tracking the movements and then reporting that information back to their agency handler.
I want to ask you a basic question, Dan, as somebody who has not served in the CIA, or at least not that I'm willing to admit. Most people recognize when there's a news flash on the local news, we're looking for this guy, and they put a picture up, and they know that in 2 or 3 days, they're likely going to find that person. When it comes to people like Baghdadi, like bin Laden, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, it seems to take so much longer. We generally know where they are. Why is it, and it's probably a very simple answer, but why is it so difficult to find these people?
Well, it's difficult, and it seems to be, no matter how much money you throw at the problem, in terms of rewards for justice, if you will, it doesn't really move the needle. And part of that is, you know, if you're offering $25 million to a sheep farmer in Afghanistan, it doesn't even resonate. That all the trailing zeros don't really make a difference. The other part of it is the culture, just the betrayal, the loyalty to their clan, their kind. Makes it very difficult and makes $25 million seem like it's not really a great deal. Of course, the other part is security. I think the really interesting thing about this particular kill operation is where it happened. And of course, that's northwest Syria. It's Idlib, or just outside of Idlib from what reports say. Not far, maybe 50 miles from the Turkish border, not far from the sea, just north of Lebanon. So to me, that tells us a couple things. One, this is essentially an area that's under Russian and Syrian control. This is not the border area of Iraq. So the fact that he chose not to hang out on just the Syrian side of the border after leaving Mosul, perhaps he could have stayed in, you know, a town like Abu Kamal. But no, he chose to go all the way to the other side of Syria. That's interesting. I suspect there's some intelligence behind that that will become clearer in the coming days or weeks or months. That gives us a better understanding of what is Turkey's role in this? What is Russia's role in this? But certainly Baghdadi felt more comfortable knowing that probably American warplanes weren't flying over, at least on a regular basis, and that all he had to do was worry about the Turks and the Russians. And it sounds like, from everything I've heard, that they really weren't that interested in him. Of course, they have different plans and desires for what they consider, you know, opposition to the Assad regime.
Right. Along those lines, is this more of a public relations victory than it is a strategic victory, do you think?
Well, it's unfortunate. I don't think President Trump has even really been able to claim this as a public relations victory. I was at the ballpark last night or Sunday night, and I mean the guy got booed on the day he killed Baghdadi. I mean, right. So if we can't even agree in this country that that's a good thing at this point in time, I don't think there's much public relations value there. On the other hand, I think there's more of a cautionary tale there that this is a part of the world that we need to stay involved in, and we need to maintain our intelligence assets and whatever limited special forces the president decides to keep in the area so that we can have more operations like this when the next number two arises.
You, of course, made the documentary Mosul with locals in the area. You know the area, you know people over there. What has been their reaction to the U.S. pullback? Because, and let me know if I'm wrong again here, but it strikes me, given the rules of engagement, which is like handing our soldiers an 80-pound weight and just telling them they have to stand there, and if a bullet comes within 5 feet, they're allowed to react. Otherwise, they have to sit back. We're... Our soldiers, which weren't very many at the time, serving more of a prophylactic role, a buffer, just don't bomb this area because there's an American there, therefore Erdogan wouldn't bomb that area, Syria would, Assad would stay away from that area because they didn't want to incur the wrath of the United States if they accidentally killed a U.S. soldier.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely part of it, you know, that kind of tripwire function that even, you know, our troops on the DMZ serve right now, that North Korea can't necessarily do what they'd like to do because our troops were there and it would start a war. So I think, you know, there's this deconfliction that happens, you know, when U.S. and Russian military operations have been taking place in Syria, and it does act as kind of a, this is our side of the road, of the railroad track, and that's your side. And of course, what the U.S. interests are in the particular regions that it's patrolling or operating in are very different than what the Russians' interests are in the areas that they're patrolling in. I'll say this for the death of Baghdadi in terms of the local reaction. You know, what we've seen and what we've heard from people that we work with in Mosul and surrounding areas, the part western and northern Iraq, they're very happy about this. I mean, this guy was, you know, a Hitler to them and to their families, and had essentially the same effect. So they're extremely, you know, happy that this guy is no more. Of course, that they also understand that the ideology component of this and how essentially ISIS was able to grow, which is one of the things that really we talk about in Mosul. That's really the theme of the whole thing. Of course, on the Syrian side of the border, they're, you know, I think they're more the information from our teams within the last couple of weeks as we're kind of looking at a follow-on project. You know, definitely within the Kurdish groups, there is some resentment. And I mean, you can see it in the pictures of the troops leaving Syria and having the tomatoes or rocks or whatever thrown at them as they're driving their MRAPs out across the border. Yeah, there's definitely a sense of betrayal with the Kurds. The Kurds are no stranger to that, by the way. We, you know, Bill Clinton did the same thing in the 90s when he essentially let Saddam slaughter them. So, yeah, this is a group of allies that we have not always been faithful to, and hopefully, you know, cooler heads will prevail in the White House, and at least the policy will be refined enough to understand that this is a group of people that we do owe a debt of gratitude towards.
Let me ask you something along those lines, Dan, as somebody who knows, forgotten more about this region than I'll ever know. It strikes me as, obviously, when Saddam Hussein was taken out, the mindset in the United States was they should be happy. They've been liberated from tyranny. But they immediately or very quickly thereafter reverted back to this tribal mentality where, you know, I hate Sunnis, hate Kurds, and Kurds hate Sunnis and Shia, and even more down lower to the ground than that.
Sure, the Syrian Kurds hate the Iraqi Kurds and Turkish Kurds, so it's a mess. Yeah.
My question is, then, and we can argue, and you may be right about the pullout now, but doesn't there have to be a point when these people in this part of the world have to stand on their own? They either have to decide we can continue to kill each other over 2,000-year-old rivalries that most people really have no idea why they even hate each other, or we can try and get our act together. Because I don't want a permanent U.S. presence, even if it just is sort of human shield-esque standing around to maintain peace to stop people from killing each other. Sooner or later, people are just going to have to decide on their own to stop killing each other.
Sure, and you're absolutely right. We can't be the policemen of the world. I think that's in large part why Trump was elected, because I think the majority of Americans understand that, and they don't have the appetite for another generation to lose limbs and whatnot in another conflict. And that said, I think the key to that, so that we don't have to send our sons and grandsons and granddaughters and daughters over there 5 years or 10 years from now to deal with whatever the next iteration of ISIS is, the key is to leverage these local partners and to make it their battle, to make it their war. And that's the problem with kind of the way this Kurdish, Turkish, Syrian situation came about. Is because if you don't have the relationships with these guys and you break their trust, then you can't count on them to do, for instance, what they did in Mosul. And again, Mosul was a story of the Iraqis taking back Mosul. There's not an American face in that. And my hope was with telling that story was to show not only the American people, but policymakers that there's a roadmap here under Operation Inherent Resolve that started in Iraq and spread to Syria and then ultimately became successful, and now we've got less than 1,000 troops in Syria. But there's a right way to do it, and it really depends on these relationships with the local partners.
But my question is, and the documentary Mosul is amazing. The footage there, whatever you paid the cameraman, you should triple it. running around in live firefights, giving a sense of the door-to-door combat to rid these monsters of this area. But it strikes me, just like in Afghanistan, the common enemy was the Taliban of the people. We came in and we aided the rebels in Afghanistan in getting rid of the Taliban. And then, well, the rebels sort of broke back into their factions. In Mosul, in more northern Iraq and in Syria there, do we run the risk of these people who were united against ISIS, united against Assad or Erdogan, whoever, whatever the cause they were fighting for, they seem to kind of be fighting in the same direction-ish. If they were to establish a kind of a permanent beachhead, a barrier where they said, this is us, leave us alone, do we have any reason to believe that they would actually be able to get along, or then would they fight amongst themselves inside that new area?
Well, yeah, you're referring to the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which goes back to the last century, of course, when the Brits and the French decided to draw lines in the sand in the desert. And unfortunately, they drew the lines a little bit off, and they split some of these groups on opposite sides of the border. So that's what we're dealing with here. Same thing we dealt with in the Durand Line, Afghanistan and Pakistan. And that's what we're still dealing with. That's what they're dealing with. So the hope is going to be that a new generation of Arabs, frankly, are going to tire of the bloodshed and be able to turn the corner on that. Of course, the gorilla in the room is something we haven't talked about, which is the Iranian influence in all of this. Mm-hmm. So, of course, Iran is involved in everything that we've seen in Iraq, including in Mosul. They funded some of the very militias that we followed that ultimately fought ISIS. So this is kind of like a friend of my friend is not necessarily my enemy type thing. And, of course, also involved in what's happening in Syria. So To say it's complicated is would be an understatement.
So then I'll ask you this last question, Dan Gabriel. I get it that the killing of al-Baghdadi was a good thing for the world, for the planet Earth. One of the most evil sons of bitches on the planet is no longer on the planet. He's currently on a spit in hell. That's a wonderful thing. But in the grand scheme of things, as far as United States national security goes, which I think everybody listening in the United States cares about, how significant were the events of last weekend?
Yeah, they're extremely significant because number one, you know, despite what we see in the news and the consternation about our force level, force posture in Syria, in Iraq, it shows that we're still committed. We're still in the fight. The president still does understand the threat that Islamic extremism poses. And he's willing to use military force when necessary. So it was a hugely bold operation. 8 helicopters flying apparently from Al Asad Air Base, which is in the western part of Iraq, really all the way across Syria, and then engaging the target. And apparently what was left of him was dropped in the sea. So he's fish food now.
Yeah, what if they didn't scrape off the ceiling as well? Actually, one more last question, Dan. Logistically, you just talked about the long helicopter ride through Russian-controlled territory, through hostile, we'll say, territory. There's a lot of complaints. Donald Trump didn't tell Congress about this, but he told the Russians about this. Somebody who knows about this stuff firsthand, has worked in this field of intelligence, talk about how absurd that, or whatever. Tell us what you think when you heard that.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, Nancy Pelosi does not have an operational need to know, and it's just as simple as that. So, sorry, Nancy. I mean, you know, I want to leave you with one thought, and we'll see whether there's any truth behind this or not. But it is something to consider again, and we've seen this kind of play out in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So where you have groups like al-Qaeda hanging out in one country on a border region, potentially supported in some way, wink, wink, nod, nod, by either a government or an element of the other government. So I'm talking in this case, the ISI, which is the Pakistani Intelligence Directorate, which we now know for a fact was in fact supporting bin Laden while he was still on the Afghan side of the border until he moved into Abbottabad. Yeah, it may be, we may see the same thing here with Turkey. And I think, maybe it's just a coincidence that all of a sudden we figured out where Baghdadi is now. Maybe there's more to meet the eye than that. And maybe that's part of the kind of recalibration with Turkey that we see going on right now. So maybe there was a quid pro quo. Prove it, but just an idea.
Do you trust Erdogan?
I do not trust him, but if part of what we get out of the deal was Baghdadi being fed to the fishes, then I guess that's a good start.
Dan Gabriel, former CIA officer, filmmaker, director of Mosul, which you can get on iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, and all that good stuff. Thanks a lot for being my guinea pig in this first ever interview in a non-video podcast.
Appreciate it, Derek. Have a great one.
You too.
Take care, buddy.
Dan sounded fine. It sounded like I had a frog in my throat and it was raping my throat. A couple other stories for you before we let you go. I told you about Max Boot at the beginning of the program. He wrote a piece over at the Washington Post because some reason, you know, I love this and I'm going to swear here, but I don't care. I made this joke once in a column at Town Hall and they deleted it. I didn't use the word shit. I used the word crap. But the Washington Post, of course, is supposed to be this big, big, fancy, very important newspaper, of course. So to write for the Washington Post is to be somebody. It's supposed to elevate you. Well, Max Boot really blows a hole in the side of that thing. And the idea that, you know, well, cream rises to the top. Sometimes shit floats, too. Max Boot is a prime example of that. He's a columnist over there. It's just one of the most tragic cases of Trump derangement syndrome ever. It just really hit Max hard. Seems like the lower the IQ, the harder the TDS really wipes you out. He wrote a piece about the death of al-Baghdadi, and it was very upset with the way that the president, a lot of people on the left were very upset with the way that the president described al-Baghdadi dying as crying and whimpering. It was, he blew himself and his three children up. You know, you grab three kids, you're a real nice guy, and go down a hole and blow yourselves up because your henchman forgot to dig your exit tunnel all the way through. Somebody doesn't understand the concept of an exit tunnel. So Max wrote a piece, quote, the assertion that Baghdadi died a coward was, in any case, contradicted by the fact that rather than be captured, he blew himself up. Yes, he's a real hero there, Max, and I'm sorry for your loss, and I'm sorry that this has happened to you, that the president said something with which you disagree, and you felt the need to write about it. Because to get something on the pages of the Washington Post, you have to write it, submit it to editors, they make changes, they send it back to you, you make changes, it goes back and forth. It's not just send it off and there it goes. So a whole bunch of people looked at that, and nobody said, Max, you sure you want to do that? You sure? Well, after receiving a whole bunch of blowback, as you might imagine, Max then edited his piece, and they added the following note, quote, an earlier version of this column included a sentence questioning whether Trump was right to call Baghdadi a coward because he blew himself up. Now, Baghdadi was known for setting people on fire and filming it, overseeing the beheadings of people, raping countless women, and overseeing and enabling the raping of countless women, throwing gay people off buildings, things like that. He never took any of them on in the ring in a fair fight. So, yeah, I would say that kind of is a coward. Said the line was removed because it unintentionally conveyed the impression that I considered Baghdadi courageous. Unintentionally, it was pretty unambiguous. He didn't die a coward, he blew himself up. Well, what is that supposed to mean, Max, if you're not saying that if you're saying he's not a coward, what are you saying? What's the opposite of coward? Run and get a dictionary, Matt. Run and get a thesaurus. Run and get something. Go to the internet and try and find something and see what you can come up with and see if you got a better answer than you got, because I bet you don't. Lastly today, well, no, two last things. I want to point out the saga of Katie Hill continues. She's the thruple swinging district congresswoman out in California who takes swing district to a new place. The Star Tribune out in California, I think it's I'm not sure what city it is. They have a piece that is very indicative of what Katie Hill, she's out there portraying herself as a victim. Now, there's naked pictures of her left and right smoking a bong, hanging out with her campaign aide and her thruple girl, making out with her, all kinds of stuff. She also resigned because she was afraid of what else was out there, which means she knows what else was out there. Video. She knows videos out there. They have a piece in the Star Tribune, a headline, Congresswoman's Exit Prompts Question of Equity Amid Scandal. You're like, what? What the hell are you talking about? The resignation of female Democratic congresswoman. Oh, thank God they made notation that she's a female Democratic congresswoman. Really? A little bit redundant? Is there no editors at the Star Tribune? Maybe not. Over a consensual sexual relationship with a campaign aide has sparked questions about whether women are held to higher standards in public life. See, the problem is she's also been credibly accused, and there's an ethics investigation. She's been accused of sleeping with her legislative director as well, which would put them on the congressional staff. See, and Congress just last year passed a law saying you cannot do that as a member of Congress. Even Nancy Pelosi isn't sticking up for this fight, but still there are some stragglers in the media who want to die on any hill they possibly can, especially Katie Hill. At the center of the controversy is Katie Hill, a first-term lawmaker from California and a rising Democratic Party star. Not anymore. In a video released Monday, Hill said that she was stepping down because she was, quote, fearful of what might come next. following the online publication of explicit pictures that outed her relationship with a female staffer. Sex scandal is nothing new in national politics and have mostly centered on men, some of whom have weathered the controversy and gone on to have successful careers. Isn't that nice? Well, they didn't happen under those new laws, the new rules that the House passed. Politico, by the way, because it is disgusting, Michael Calderon has a piece. Reporter on Katie Hill scandal promotes GOP candidates for her seat. Turns out that a writer for the conservative website Red State is a conservative. Who would have thought such a thing? This is a revelation to Politico, and they write a very long piece digging into the past of the female reporter, Jennifer Van Laar, who broke the Katie Hill story. Why? Because this is how the left works. Remember, this is how the left works. My good friend, Joe the Plumber, remember him? He actually is a good friend. Went to his wedding, know his wife, he's having kids left and right. Good guy. He made the mistake of asking then-candidate Barack Obama in 2008 a simple question about taxes. And Barack Obama came back with the, well, if you spread the wealth around, everybody's better off. Straight up socialism. The feces hit the fan, and the media immediately took action. They did not dig into anything other than Joe's past. You know that his real name is not Joe. His first name's Sam. He's not a licensed plumber. He's been divorced. He's this. He's that. He's the other thing. Within 3 days of Joe asking a simple question because a politician walked down his street seeking questions, within 3 days we knew more about Joe than we still know about Barack Obama to this day. You ever read an interview with high school friends or college friends or an ex-girlfriend of Barack Obama's? You ever seen a 60 Minutes profile on anybody fitting that description? No, you haven't. You ever figured out how it was that a guy in his first autobiography who describes himself as a member of the Choom Gang, smoking weed constantly and skipping school, managed to get into three of the nation's most prestigious colleges? We don't know, and no journalist bothered to ask, but we knew all about Joe the Plumber's background, and we know all about the reporter at Red State's background, yet the stories on Katie Hill still focus on the campaign staffer, which is not against House rules, and ignore or gloss over the legislative director that led to the House ethics investigation. So she's a victim, ladies and gentlemen, which is, you know, hard currency on the left. And also a victim is the truth and any sort of credibility left in journalism. Lastly today, speaking of losing credibility and the end of Western civilization, Business Insider, Pizza Hut is testing out a... Pizza Hut, it's hard to say, I'm going to choke on it. Pizza Hut is testing out a plant-based meat topping called Incogmeato. Yes, the impossible waffle. Just stop. Don't. If you don't eat meat, you don't eat meat. It's pretty simple. If you eat meat, eat meat. If you don't eat meat, don't eat it. To pretend like, oh, if we just take up all these yard clippings and run them through a compressor and add a little bit of beans to it, well, suddenly your mouth won't know the difference. Yes, your mouth will know the difference. It tastes like crap. Now, if you want to eat crap, go ahead. Just come up with a new name for it. It's not meat unless it was once alive. It's not beef unless it used to moo. We don't have very many standards left in this country, but damn it, that is one where we should draw the line and stop ruining pizza and hamburgers. Eat your tofu, shut your mouth, and live the lifestyle you've chosen to live, you weirdo. That is all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening, telling a friend, and all that good stuff. Don't forget to enter to win the Jarrett Stepman book if you want. Email me, Derek@DailyCaller.com, about anything if you want. And have a great Tuesday, whether you want to or not. And I'll be back here tomorrow. See you then.